Sally, do you have a philosophy of dance, of what you want in your dance pieces?
If I don't know by now, I don't know when I'm ever going to know. It's hard to verbalize because mostly it's about the response to what's happening that gives me, each piece becomes a special piece to me.
The response to what's happening.
What's happening when I'm watching, when I'm making a piece of work. Hmm. And my response, you know, while I'm doing it. So it's not like I go in there with a formal idea and formal phrases, but I come in with a concept. And so it's more conceptual. And I've worked with people for many, many years, the same performers. When I'm talking about a small company that I have in New York, and I hardly have to either do something or say something, and it's almost as if they intuit what it is I'm thinking about.
So does that mean that every performance is different, even if presumably it's the same piece?
It's always different. Well, that's always true about all performance, I think, because every performance is different. You can't repeat a performance. You can't, even with absolutely prescribed choreography. That's why they can keep doing the Nutcracker every year, because somebody else is dancing the leads, and you're going to get a different quality. So I expect, that is something I expect anyway, and I hope for anyway, and I wouldn't want it to be the same. The particular thing about my work is that I leave a lot of time and space for the dancers within the piece itself. So the piece is structured and it's formal, but at the same time, within this formal structure, there are no counts. There's just the breath that they're working on and the relationship to each other. And what amazed me was that these students who I've had just for one semester I really felt like they were able to achieve a sense of community and ease when they did their performance.
You mentioned breath. How does that figure into dance?
Because that's what we exist on, is the breath. It's the inhale and the exhale that keeps us all, that guarantees us that we're living. And it's only because we're alive that we can even take on the idea of performing.
But how does that translate that into what people would do on a dance floor?
On a dance floor. So if there are no counts to get somewhere, how do you know when to be there? So you're breathing, you can feel the other person breathing, and you get a sense of this is the moment to go. And then you go. And it's the breath that carries you there.
So you don't necessarily decide this ahead of time. It
Absolutely.
Just kind of happens.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, you're really talking about
freedom.
Improvisation here.
I'm talking about improvisation. I'm talking about freedom and risk-taking at once.
Huh. Now, one of the pieces you created was called The Pleasure of Stillness, and there was a documentary film of the same title made about you. What does stillness mean to you?
Stillness comes to mean that there's movement. Within stillness, there is always movement. We think that still is still. There is no still. Because if you're breathing, you're not still. If the fluids in your body are moving, you're not still. So it's even harder to work with a move when you're not moving, to keep the sense of being alive and present. So there's presence in the stillness.
But it's so interesting to hear a dancer talk about stillness because, of course, you know, the first thing that comes to mind with dance is you're moving, which would seem to be
exactly,
the opposite.
But everybody would have said that what comes to mind in silence, in music, in sound, is no sound. But, of course, there's sound because there's sound in the room even if your hand is not touching the piano. Thank you, John Cage.
I was just going to ask you about this. This sounds so much like John Cage.
But it is John Cage, and it really came out of a lot of the work that I do, and I was not part of the first workshop that was taught that was based on lots of John Cage principles he had and was taught by the person who accompanied the accompanist to Merce Cunningham, mm-hmm. who was Robert Dunn, and he taught a first workshop of people from various disciplines, and it became what then ultimately became the Judson Dance Theater, which started in 1962, and I was part of the second workshop. So I learned a lot. And are my principles. Those are my principles, that this is joy and this is play. And if it isn't joyful and playful, then you shouldn't be doing it. So doing it really means showing up. Just keep doing it without being sure that you know how it's going to all come out.
Did you know John Cage?
I never met. I've said hello to John Cage and lived in the building. I still live in the building that Merce Cunningham had his studio in, and been at many performances they were at many social events, even though I never probably engaged them in conversation, except just once with Merce at a Thanksgiving party when I said, "Are you ever tired?" And he simply said, "Is there a dancer who is ever not tired?" That was enough. I couldn't even say anything else while John was in the kitchen heating. It was Thanksgiving dinner, and John was heating their macrobiotic dinner, you know. But I certainly was around them a lot during that period.
Now, as I listen to you and hear about your philosophy of stillness and movement and the interplay and silence, it sounds kind of Buddhist in some ways. And
you know more either. You know a lot about a lot of things. You know a lot about me that I didn't know you knew.
And, of course, John Cage was influenced by Buddhism. Are you a Buddhist?
I don't call myself anything, but I do have a practice, and I've been practicing a long time.
Meditative practice?
Yeah. It is. It's Vipassana, which is insight meditation. So I'm not waiting for an enlightenment. I'm just hoping I can have an insight. I would be really pleased.
So how has your Buddhist practice, if you want to call it that, how has that informed the way you think about dance?
I kind of can't even begin a day without being. I don't feel like a human being unless I take the time to be in silence and stillness. It's a preparation for my everyday life, and I hope to keep it. It becomes my life during the day, and I don't feel separated from it. And it has changed my life in many ways. I think I was always very more reactive than responsive, and that's an enlightenment. That's an insight into yourself to realize that you really have to listen, that you don't have to speak all the time, that you have to open your heart. And it's what I what I hope to do when I'm doing the work that I'm doing. So I don't cut myself off from the world at all. In fact, I'm in the world as much as I can be. So that means going to museums, reading newspapers, staying, being political, being active. Did I say going to museums and reading books? And reading is an important part of my life. And there have been people whose work has totally influenced what I do. So I think it's quality and not quantity.
It's so fascinating to hear you talk about your philosophy, not just of dance, but of living well, because, I mean, the image that comes to me is there's really no clear dividing line between what would happen in a dance performance and just how you
well,
live.
I wish you had been there and seen what happened. It was really, I mean, this enormous museum space, and not knowing that many people were going to be there, and how is this going to manifest itself? What will they get from it? And I got so much out of the responses when I was so concerned that people weren't going to see everything. And then when somebody says it didn't matter anymore, that I didn't see, I would have liked to have seen everything. But I became part of the experience. So it was not a performance, really. It was an experience for the performers. And I try to talk to them about that, that this is just another experiment in your life, another experience in your life. If you put such a strong word on it, like this is the one and only performance, then the idea of that it has to be a success, that's never the way I feel. I don't think about
aren't there,
success.
Aren't there better performances and worse performances, though?
What there are different performances, not better. I don't think better or worse anymore. I've got to try to get no judgment. Sure, preferences. I mean, that's a discerning mind. I mean, I'm not giving up wisdom, and I'm not making choices. I mean, we do choose the people we spend our time with. Hopefully it's people of like mind, so you have less and less conflict. There's enough conflict out there.
Now, you were one of the founding members of the Judson Dance Theater, which is typically described as the original postmodern dance company, which was reacting against Martha Graham and much of what modern dance was doing. What were you reacting against? What were you trying to do that was different?
I was the perfect person to fit into that because I could never do their techniques. And if I didn't find my own voice, I was really going to get lost in the crowd. So it was, you know, just the idea that you could hear again and again from Bob and Judy Dunn, who taught this course, you've got to take risks. You've got to find other structures. You can't rely on a piece of music to make every piece that you make. If you've got to learn how to use silence meaning, you know, let's say no music for a piece, and I'm not afraid to make a piece in silence.
But don't modern dancers take risks? And you know?
Do they? No, most of it is most of it is. I mean, you could look at the ABA structure in music and see the same thing in modern dance. I'm not criticizing all of modern dance, and there wouldn't have been Judson if there hadn't been something else. So there was, you know what I mean? It's like there wouldn't have been. There wouldn't have been abstract expressionism, and if there hadn't been narrative figurative art, mm-hmm. there wouldn't have been conceptual art. If there hadn't been abstract art, things grow. You know, there's change, and there's people who have other ideas and other ways of realizing things, and it was just a time to. And I think up until that point, it was so much narrative dance. It was the thing about maybe the narrative that the reaction was against.
So there was the sense that, say, if you went to see a Martha Graham performance, there was a story that was being told. And it was theatrical.
Nothing wrong with that. You know, if you like that, that's fine. But you had to feel that if you felt that you needed to do something else, you had to be willing to do that. I mean, the Graham pieces are still being done.
So what does it mean if you do dance with no narrative then?
Then you're depending on yourself to make the material, and you're putting yourself out there to take a risk that you're going to make anybody's going to enjoy it or not. And other critics are going to come and look at it. But, you know, after a while, they didn't really have much choice. You know, do you want one anecdote?
Yes, please.
You know, the anecdote is mm-hmm. when I wrote my own text, I didn't know whether it was, I mean, I just had faith in what I wrote. I knew what I was writing about. It was totally incomprehensible to anybody else but myself. And I read it on tape. You know, it was when you did everything yourself, reel to reel. And then I proceeded to, the dance really was based on moves from baseball. I was a baseball addict as a child, and I paid attention. And, you know, so I got out there, and I had somebody construct the wall so that I could lean up there and get the, you know, the fly, the catch, and the, you know, back up against the wall. And this narrative was part of it. It was ongoing. And the critic in the New York Times said, is it something like, well, I'm paraphrasing it, I think this woman may be insane, but she sure can run. I was running bases, but he didn't know I was running bases, but I was having a really good time. But I wasn't afraid to take a chance to do that. I mean, I had to do that.
There's another piece that I've seen snippets of video from that you did with your daughter, she's sitting in a stool, and you are, is it brushing her hair?
Brushing her hair.
Standing next to her, brushing her hair. Describe that piece.
I mean, there's always a backstory. Why would I do this? I mean, I had done this many times with her, but why at this age I no longer was brushing her hair? But, oh, truth be known, I had just been at St. Vincent's Hospital brushing the hair of a 19-year-old girl who is the daughter of a friend and who was my friend, who was dying from cystic fibrosis. And it was the last time I brushed her hair. And with cystic fibrosis, it's very difficult to catch your breath. And the piece was called Petit Air, Little Air. And so I sat her in a chair, and the chair was a rotating chair, so I just had, she was moving it, and you didn't see her moving it as the chair rotated, sort of like a barbershop chair, except it wasn't. It was a rather beautiful chair, and I still have that chair. And I brushed her hair, and then proceeded to where we did a duet on the floor together, where I mostly basically assisted her in sitting up, turning her from side to side. And so I had taken the movement from having worked with somebody. And ultimately, there was each of us did a small, short solo. And then we came together at the end as I helped her leave with my hands on her back as she just moved up and out. And, you know, you could write, now you know the narrative, and the narrative wasn't even a part of it while I was doing it, but...
But I mean, it's so interesting how you've drawn on parts of your own life. So there was the experience of being with this young woman in the hospital who was dying, brushing her hair, also doing it with your own daughter. And, you know, I assume it's sort of hearkening back to when you would brush her hair, her hair when she was a small child.
And so it still makes the hair that I don't have on my arms anymore stand up. And my heart still pound for that because ultimately I was brushing my mother's hair, you know, when she no longer was brushing her hair, you know. And there, I mean, things reverberate in one's life. And I think everything I do comes from my life. So every object in my apartment that is connected to my studio has probably been incorporated in a piece because it's my life. And I don't separate it, and I get my movement material from the use of these materials. You know, I've done pieces where I've set the table. Nobody knows I'm setting the table, but I am setting the table. I can put the plate down, I can put the napkin down, I fork, 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 and as many forks as I like, you know, until I run out of forks.
I'm struck by the words that you use. I mean, you often talk about movement rather than dance. And, I mean, the obvious question that someone would ask about this piece, you know, brushing your daughter's hair is, what makes that dance?
Don't ask me. I don't know where the line is drawn. Is there a line anymore? Are there lines? You know, I don't know.
I mean, don't we categorize art? I mean, don't we say, you know, this is, you are going to a dance performance and, you know, it's billed as dance and that's what draws people to see it?
You know, I don't really call it that anymore. They call the people who sometimes where you do your performances may call it a dance performance. I don't even use the word dance concert anymore. You know, the last experiences have actually been in my studio, and I say, you know, doing work in my studio, if you'd like to come and see it, there's room for 18 people. So please make a reservation, and that doesn't cost anything, and we'll be sure you get a little wine before you leave. But remember, you're going to probably, you know, be moved around a little bit. I'm going to pause and rearrange the chairs instead of calling them intermission, you know.
Well, and I think the other assumption that comes with dance is that there is a certain training that goes into that. There's sort of a body of knowledge of experience that you must develop to become a dancer. Are you trying to sort of break down that division between performers and just everyday people?
Well, actually, the people who work with me are all trained. They've all trained. They're older, and they don't go to ballet class anymore, but they all do some kind of movement, and they're all prepared, and they're all ready, and they know how to warm up their own bodies. And I could ask them to do things that I couldn't maybe ask somebody untrained. But the incredible aspect of this experience here was people coming from different departments and actually taking on movement when they so-called movement, you know, which dancers do, and they do it in a very sophisticated way, but it didn't maybe. Sophisticated meaning, you know, if you're counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, they're there. But it didn't stop anybody in this group of, you know, a group of musicians, people from the art department. They just participated, and they did everything. They were able to take this on.
When you say they took on movement, what does that mean? I mean, what I'm trying to get at is what you know, who spent your life in dance or whatever you want to call it, you know, how you think about movement as opposed to someone else to, you know, has no background in this area who, you know, has maybe sort of never really thought about, you know, how we move in our daily lives.
Uh, So I would begin with, we would begin with breathing, and we would begin with walking. And generally, if I do a workshop, that's the way it begins. And then we begin with what's known as, what might be called and is called, the four dignities, which are basic activities that we do, which is really all we do in life, except we some, and then we sometimes extend it. So what the example of that is that we basically lie down, then you learn to sit up, then you learn to stand up, and then you learn to walk. And that's basically all we're doing. So
that's life, those four things.
So walking then becomes running if you do it a little faster. It becomes leaping if you take it off the floor. So that's the way I begin when I start working with people, whether it's a mixture of performers. And I do this with the dancers all the time who I work with. I do it with myself. And just yesterday, a woman who's a writer who knows a lot about movement said, you know, I've been spending too much time in a chair. I need something to get me moving. What should I do? I said, work with the four dignities, because every change you make is a change, and every change, be it most subtle. So if you're sitting and you simply turn yourself to the left or the right, or you move an arm, you've made a change and you've moved a part of the body. So how do you go from lying down to sitting up? And you don't have to do it all in, you know, quickly. You don't have to do it slowly. But then you could decide that you want to do it quicker and slower, and you get the body flowing and the movement flowing. And then you can take it up on your feet, and then you can do the same activities, lying, standing, sitting, and walking on your feet. So if you say to somebody, lie down, and they're standing up, they'll probably tip over. Well, that's fine. That's lying down. That's where I begin everything.
And where do you go from there? I mean, if someone is in one of your movement classes, let's say it's been in for years, as I know some people are, how do they think about their bodies? How do they move differently than when they started?
Well, because I spend a lot of time on the anatomical structure. Like, wait a minute, you're standing up, but your belly's falling out. But how do we work with that? And then I would work a lot on alignment, you know, making sure that people understand about the parts of their body, and introduce the skeleton with, you know, and people accept it. They're happy to know that. I mean, I work with young people and I talk about it, you know, the Tai Chi students at City College. They don't know, and some of them have children, but they take them to the doctor. They don't know what the cervical spine is. And I want them to know when they're talking to people what the body is about, so that they're educated. So that becomes a part of it. I don't separate myself. And actually, I think of myself as an educator. then I become a choreographer. Then I become a performer.
Do you think most of us just don't really think about our bodies, or not aware of our bodies?
Absolutely. I think we really are all in our minds, and we really separate the body from the mind. There are just the people who are just mind people. And you don't have to look in the mirror, you know, to talk to somebody about their body. You know, some of us never look in the mirror and still love the body.
What changes then once we gain this knowledge of our bodies?
Then you can become a whole person, because then you have a body and a mind, and that's what we have. That's what people have that all animals don't have. We do have a mind. We can make choices, and we have a body. And we are the body that stands on two feet, which is extraordinary. That, you know, these little feet are holding up this enormous structure, and if we don't take care of it, you know, who will take care of it?
This sounds like a lesson in life rather than a lesson in dance.
Ooh, have I disappointed you?
No, you've expanded it. I mean, is that what you're after here?
Yeah. Yes. What do they say?
Thank you very much.
And thank you for having me.
Yeah, that was terrific. Thank you.